From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. A greater percentage of blacks than whites opposed the Gulf War. On today's Fresh Air, we try to find out why. We talk with Diane Pinderhughes, who wrote the chapter on the Gulf in the National Urban League's annual report on the state of black America. And we speak with Demo Smith, the co-founder of the African American Network Against U.S. Intervention in the Gulf. Also, Imam Muhammad Abdul Alim, a leader of Philadelphia's African American Muslim community, tells us why he supports the war. And Ed Dorn of the Brookings Institution examines race and class in the military and weighs the benefits and burdens for blacks who volunteer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. military said today that Allied warplanes destroyed 24 Iraqi tanks, armored personnel carriers, and supply vehicles in a desert convoy on Monday night. A Marine Corps spokesman said the convoy was spotted by a Marine reconnaissance unit on the Saudi side of the border. He said the Iraqi vehicles appeared to be on a routine maneuver and not preparing for an attack. The Marines called down an airstrike and were reportedly able to see the Iraqi vehicles burning from their positions. The Israeli government has announced the arrest of a prominent Palestinian leader in East Jerusalem. Tsari Nusseibeh was accused of collecting information to aid Iraq in its attacks on Israel. NPR's John Hockenberry reports.
Tsari Nusseibeh is a philosophy professor at Beer Zeit University in the occupied West Bank. Nusseibeh has long espoused moderate positions, calling for recognition of Israel and for nonviolent compromise with Israel, positions that have gotten him in trouble with the far more numerous radical Palestinian groups in the West Bank. But tonight, Tsari Nusseibeh is in trouble with Israeli authorities. It is the first arrest for Nusseibeh, and in announcing it, a statement from Israel's defense ministry said that he had been collecting information for Iraqi intelligence, especially, the statement said, after missile attacks against Israel. A family member called the allegations against Tsari Nusseibeh complete nonsense. This is John Hockenberry in Tel Aviv.
Medical sources in southern Lebanon said today that at least two people were killed and five wounded when an Israel shelled a Palestinian refugee camp near the city of Tyre. Israeli warships and artillery units launched an hour-long artillery attack on the Rashidiya camp in reprisal for a Palestinian rocket attack on Israeli positions in southern Lebanon. The Palestine Liberation Organization supports Iraq in the Gulf War, and the rocket attack aroused fears that the PLO might be opening a new Lebanon-based front against Israel. A few hundred more refugees straggled across the border between Iraq and Jordan today with more stories about conditions inside occupied Kuwait. NPR's John Burnett reports.
A Syrian businessman crossing into Jordan today reported the Kuwaitis who remain inside Kuwait City are waiting fearfully for the beginning of the Allied ground assault. He said they're living under a dusk-to-dawn curfew imposed by wary Iraqi troops. The businessman, who left Kuwait's capital 2 days ago, says Kuwaitis are also bored because there's no television. This refugee, one of the fortunate ones, he drove a Mercedes, said Kuwait City is paralyzed. People have stopped going to work and everyone's money is frozen in the banks. The Iraqi army is reportedly distributing food from vans. A Kuwaiti civil servant crossing the border today was quoted as saying the Iraqi army is so well entrenched in Kuwait that he doubts whether Allied ground forces can drive them out. In Amman, I'm John Burnett reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 8 points today to close at 2,662. This is NPR. The Pentagon said today that Iraq appears to be attempting to move its warplanes away from bombed airfields and onto highways and into woods. Spokesman Pete Williams said that Iraqi pilots are driving some warplanes to highway intersections or parking in wooded areas and other places away from military installations. Iraq is believed to have built aircraft shelters along highways in case its airfields were damaged. For the first time, researchers are trying to cure a cancer using human gene therapy. Today, two patients at the National Institutes of Health received a stronger version of their own immune system cells, cells that have been genetically altered to produce a tumor-fighting drug. NPR's Michael Scholar has more.
The theory behind the new treatment is simple. The two patients have a deadly skin cancer known as melanoma that has spread throughout their bodies. Their immune cells try to fight the cancer, but are losing the battle. so Dr. Steven Rosenberg and colleagues at the National Cancer Institute remove some of the patient's tumor-fighting immune cells, grow billions of copies, and then give them a boost by putting into the cells the genetic recipe for an anti-cancer drug called tumor necrosis factor. Then the cells go back into the patient, where it is hoped they will seek out a tumor and stick to it, churning out the anti-cancer drug. The theory sounds good, and earlier tests on animals were successful, but this is only the second time gene therapy has been tried in people, and it will take some months before doctors even have a hint of whether the treatment can help to fight cancer. This is Michael Scholer in Washington.
A private research group said today that Americans' faith in the economy fell to a 10-year low this month. The Conference Board said that consumer confidence was eroded by uncertainty about the war and the recession. The group's Consumer Confidence Index, which measured 100 in the base year of 1985, fell to 54 this month. It was just over 61 last month. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A number of recent polls have shown a sharp division between the way African Americans and white Americans view U.S. involvement in the Gulf. While whites support the war by a ratio of 4-1, blacks are about evenly split. We'll be exploring the particular concerns of African Americans on the war from a number of perspectives today. My first guest, political science professor Diane Pinderhughes, documented the disproportionate representation of blacks in the military in the National Urban League's annual State of Black America report. Blacks make up 12% of the nation's civilian population, but close to 25% of the armed forces. When we spoke, Professor Pinderhughes said the high numbers of blacks in the military is a phenomenon that started when the draft ended.
With the removal of the draft, whites could choose not to join. Blacks could also choose not to join, but they didn't have the same range of choices in the private sector that whites had for employment, for advancement on the job, for equal pay. And so you began to have a situation in which you had a larger number of blacks choosing the military, because that was more accessible. The private sector did not have the same range of choices, did not have the same rewards. And so you began to have a kind of pushing blacks out of the private sector. With the all-volunteer force, the military had to work harder at attracting people. And the military basically had a money that would support higher education, additional training. It had a guarantee of a job if you could gain access to it. And so you began to have a gradual increase in the proportions of blacks, not only entering, but re-enlisting, and for that matter, even surviving the first tour of duty. There's a much higher rate of survival on the part of blacks than whites. The individual who has graduated from high school is much more likely to survive in the military than one who has not. So you have 95% of blacks having graduated from high school and only 85% of whites having graduated from high school, who entered the military.
So you're suggesting that the military is really used by a lot of blacks in the military as a job opportunity, as an opportunity that's lacking in the society at large.
Absolutely.
So is there a feeling of betrayal when the people in the military are actually asked to make the ultimate commitment, which is to go to war?
I think people feel angry that they're not a wider range of choices for the African-American population. And the difference in the choices means that blacks are much less likely to have the opportunities for participating in more lucrative, less lethal occupations than whites do. American policies in regards to employment in the private sector are much weaker, have been in existence for a much shorter period of time, and rather than being consistently applied, have gradually diminished in the federal government's commitment, at least, to implementation of affirmative action policies or even equal employment policies. And therefore, significant numbers end up in the military, and I suppose the word betrayal is not inappropriate under those circumstances.
What recommendations are you making?
Okay, well, mine is, for one, has to do with employment policy in the U.S. Affirmative action needs to be supported. The 1991 Civil Rights Act depending upon how it's constructed. It's not in existence, as far as I know, at present, should be passed to the extent that it strengthens and reinforces policies that have been carried out before it but have been struck down by the Supreme Court dealing with affirmative action and minority set-asides. I would also, my article in particular, ask us to think about energy issues, educational issues, how we spend our money. We're willing to invest enormous amounts of money in equipment. We're willing to invest enormous amounts of money in personnel and in African-American personnel when they're involved in wars. We ought to be willing to invest in them when we are engaged in peace and also when people are in the private sector.
Diane Pinderhughes is a political science professor at the University of Illinois and the author of The Case of African Americans in the Persian Gulf, which is part of the National Urban League's annual report on the state of Black America. The proportionately high representation of African Americans in the Gulf is only one of the reasons that higher percentages of blacks than whites oppose the war. My next guest, Damu Smith, says there are many others. Smith is a co-founder of the African American Network Against U.S. Intervention in the Gulf. We spoke today about why he felt a separate African-American anti-war group was necessary.
Well, first of all, because of the high sentiment of opposition within the African-American community towards U.S. policy in the Gulf, we decided that it was necessary to form an organization specifically to organize that sentiment into a political force. Because while our interests coincide with all Americans who oppose U.S. policy in the Gulf, there are some special reasons that transcend those general reasons that pertain specifically to African Americans.
What are some of those special reasons?
Well, we are serving in the Gulf in disproportionate numbers. One of four people serving in the Gulf are black, and 30% of the Army's infantry forces are black, and 48% of the women in the armed services are black. And so we are the ones who will be dying first and the most, particularly when the ground war starts in this conflict. And the reason we are in the Army and the armed forces in general in disproportionate numbers is because of what we consider the racist poverty draft. That is, the fact, the circumstances that lead us to go into the military have to do with economic opportunities that we feel we can get in the military because of the lack of opportunities in the civilian sector. However, when we go into the military, especially under the Reagan, during the Reagan years and now under the Bush administration, we are finding that the most dramatic opportunities that we get are the opportunities to go to invade Grenada and invade Panama and go to Lebanon and be part of special forces in Nicaragua advising the Contras and go to El Salvador and advise the right-wing government there and now go to Saudi Arabia. Those are not the kinds of opportunities that African Americans have signed up for in the military, but that's the situation we find ourselves in, along with young whites who are also in the military. And we feel that none of these young people should be over there. This is a needless war. It's an unnecessary military confrontation, and we shouldn't be there.
I don't know if you're in a position to answer this or not, but I was wondering if you could give a sense of how you think the debate within white America and black America compares right now. And I don't know if you can use the example of your friends or different groups that you belong to or different factions within the peace movement.
Well, the polls have shown that the sentiment against the war is higher in the black community than it is among whites. And that's not because blacks are any less patriotic than whites, because history proves that we are just as patriotic as whites, because we are always the ones who are signing up to go in the military and to fight in America's wars abroad. But I think that this time around, in light of the Vietnam War debacle, black Americans are raising more questions in greater numbers than whites. I think the African Americans are saying they don't want their sons and daughters to die in a needless war. We have fundamental questions about the policy, and we don't think we ought to be there.
I think a lot of African Americans see Bush as being unsympathetic to civil rights. And I'm wondering if you think that that has affected the stand of African Americans who oppose the war on the war. In other words, does the opposition have anything to do with black perceptions of George Bush?
The fact that the administration vetoed the civil rights bill and has sought to deny and restrict scholarships for African American and other minority students certainly has dampened the enthusiasm by many African Americans for going off to fight in a distant land in a military conflict that is viewed as unnecessary. And I think that African Americans cannot have enthusiasm for going off to fight when we are being denied our civil rights and our human rights right here at home.
What do you see as being the economic issues of this war that most affect African Americans?
Well, this war is a very expensive conflict. We've heard estimates from $19 million an hour to $3 billion a day to $30 billion a month, depending on who you're talking to. But no matter where you hear the numbers from or who you hear the numbers from, the numbers are high. And this is going to have long-term and disastrous economic consequences on the African-American community, because the billions of dollars that are being spent on this war are billions that cannot be available for daycare and child care and low and moderate income housing and decent health care facilities in our communities, and money available for scholarships and student loans. And so for all of the American population in general, this conflict will have those kind of negative economic consequences. And on top of that, you're talking about so many African-American breadwinners and income providers who are being taken away. You're talking about stabilizing forces within the African-American community who've been snatched away and been sent off. So taken all together, this war is going to have a devastating impact on the black community economically for all the reasons that I've given.
General Colin Powell is an African-American, and I think he's a great source of pride with two African-Americans. But on the other hand, I sense some ambivalence about him in this war. Could you talk about that?
Well, I think for many African-Americans, having Colin Powell, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, certainly is a source of pride, because, after all, we have been denied opportunities in every aspect of American society and all of its institutions, and we've always known that we could do, we could lead, we could perform if we were given the opportunity. So I think in that sense, Colin Powell's position in the military has been a source of pride for many African Americans. On the other hand, it gives many African Americans no sense of pride about the fact that he is the one that has helped to implement the kind of foreign policy that our nation is pursuing abroad. Our military and foreign policy is interventionist, militarist, and racist in form and in content. And he is the one that has happened to, he is the chief military officer in the country that has happened to implement that policy. That is anathema to blacks who see the role of our country as one of trying to, what it ought to be is to defend democracy and support human rights.
During Vietnam, there were a lot of splits within families. Families split about, you know, being for war or against the war. And I'm wondering, with opposition to this war being what it is among African Americans, if you're starting to see that kind of problem too, of splits within families or splits between friends on where people stand on the war.
Well, we haven't encountered much of that. What we have encountered are people who are simply confused and ambivalent about their son or daughter's or relative's participation in the war. And this is one of the reasons why the African-American Network has been formed. We think it is so important for black Americans and other Americans to know why they are being sent off to fight in a conflict abroad. And they must have more reasons than the ones being provided by the administration. We want to be more probing, more analytical, more searching. We are finding that when we do that, people do begin to raise more questions, and actually people start questioning why we're there and move into a position of opposition to the war. Among other things, we point out the inconsistencies in U.S. policy. I mean, the U.S. has never mobilized the international community to impose comprehensive, mandatory, multilateral sanctions against the Republic of South Africa for its crimes against black people under apartheid, or for its 21-year illegal occupation of Namibia, or for its many years of occupying the southern territory of the People's Republic of Angola. We've never seen our government mobilize the international community to apply comprehensive multilateral sanctions against Israel for its mistreatment of the Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, nor to sanction Israel for its repeated invasions of Lebanon. I mean, there are inconsistencies in the policy, and when we tell African Americans and other Americans these things, they begin to say, oh, yeah, I see what you're saying. So why are we really there? And then we say the reason we're there is because of oil. It's not worth one American life. It's just not.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. Listen, thank you so much.
Demo Smith is a co-founder of the African-American Network Against U.S. Intervention in the Gulf. Coming up, a talk with an African-American Muslim leader who supports the war. This is Fresh Air. The war in the Gulf has presented an unusual and difficult situation for African-American Muslims. For the first time, they and their leaders have had to wrestle with the question of whether Muslims in the American military should engage in fighting against Muslims in the Middle East. The holy book of the Islamic faith, the Quran, says that when a dispute arises between two Muslims, they must seek to make peace. How that aim should be accomplished has been the source of debate amongst Muslim religious leaders. In September, the International Islamic Conference met in Mecca to discuss this and resolved that it would be allowed to use force to get Iraq out of Kuwait because Saddam Hussein is a wrongful aggressor. A delegation returned to Saudi Arabia just before the war began and reaffirmed the position. Imam Muhammad Abdul Alim participated in both meetings. He's the leader of the West Oak Lane Mosque in Philadelphia. I asked him about the internal debate in the African-American Muslim community.
African-Americans oftentimes, there's a lot of emotional, very strong emotional feelings toward this because we tend to speak a lot from hurt in terms of our relationship with America. So as a result, you had a lot of people initially, without any regards for the information or the details of the struggle, immediately sided with Saddam because it was sort of thing that anyone who is against America, they're for that person, right or wrong. But however, as Muslims, we are required to go to our holy book, which is the Quran, and look at how problems and conflicts are to be resolved. So as we got a more informed opinion, then you begin to see a shifting in the position of the African-American Muslim community.
You are the leader of a mosque in Philadelphia.
Yes.
What kinds of concerns are people bringing to you now from the mosque?
Well, basically, what we have several types. One is that, based on our position is that we support the position of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in terms of its calling in armed American forces. There are some members of the community who take the position that we should not have supported that because they don't feel that we should have non-Muslim forces in Arabia. All right, that's one area of concern. Another area of concern is since the troops are there, should we support the American government in its having the troops there? This is a very hotly debated issue because Muslims hate the idea of Muslims fighting Muslims and Muslims fighting Muslims with non-Muslims on the side of one Muslim group. So these are some of the concerns.
Do you know of any African-American Muslims who are in the military or who have loved ones in the military, people
yes.
who you work with?
Yes.
And what are their concerns?
Well, their concern was, in fact, it's interesting. Now, we went to Saudi Arabia, in fact, on the 14th of this month, just before the war started. And our initial, purposes were going to give moral support to the almost between 600 to 1,000 Muslim troops that are in the armed forces, especially in the ground forces among our African-American people, because they had concerns that it was expressed in terms of fighting Muslims, you know, and the whole idea of fighting Muslims and fighting during the month of Ramadan if war had broken out. But as we know, it did break out. And when we have been very, very clear from the Quran that it is permissible for them to fight both during Ramadan, and it's permissible for them to fight against an aggressor, even though that aggressor claims to be Muslim.
A lot of African-American Muslims have converted in their lifetime as opposed to being born into the religion. And I think that there's probably a lot of African-American families in which the family has some members who are Christians and mm-hmm. some members who are Muslims. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what effect you've seen that having on families now during wartime.
Even before the war, the idea of the inner religious families require on the part of the Muslims to be more considerate of the fact that they are the ones that have changed and not their families. And if so, even before this war started, the Muslims who are members of households that are Christian have been challenged to show the rational and well-meaning side of Islam. For instance, you hear a lot of times the word jihad, holy war. If a family member don't understand what Islam really means, and they hear this term coming out, they want to know from their sons and their daughters, are you going to be part of this holy war? Are you Muslim going to be fighting in America? And the people are concerned about that.
How do you explain holy war to Muslims?
Well, firstly, you know, the whole term of jihad, this is one of the things that we caution the Muslims in the international world. We should stop calling national fervor is Islamic holy war. You know, if I'm having a fight with you, I cannot use the term jihad in my struggle with you, especially if I'm wrong. Also, based on what our prophet has said, he lets us know that jihad first is a personal struggle of the individual against the evils of his own self. Then the next level of jihad is against an enemy that is stopping you from practicing your religion. And the final level of jihad is against the forces of Satan, which is just a normal struggle of good versus evil.
What kind of advice have you found yourself most often giving people now?
Well, the most important thing that I find myself talking with Muslims about is the idea of being better informed. Because this crisis has really shown us what we consider the Islamic neglect on the part of many Muslims to know the religion. You know, it's so easy for people who are misinformed to be manipulated. And this is one of the problems we found both here in this country and in the international world with Muslims who are, in many cases, totally misinformed about the real basis of this struggle, are reacting from an emotional side, an emotional position. And this is one of the strongest things we've been really finding on the part of Muslims. Become better informed.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Certainly.
Imam Muhammad Abdul Alim is the leader of the West Oak Lane Mosque in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Many African Americans who oppose the war in the Gulf say that blacks are facing disproportionate risks because of their disproportionately high representation in the military. And, the argument goes, there's a high proportion of blacks in the military because the military offers education and job opportunities that aren't available to poor and working class blacks in the civilian world. Coming up, weighing the benefits and burdens of serving, we talk with Ed Dorn of the Brookings Institution. He studied race and class in the U.S. military. Ed Dorn coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Saudi Arabia, military officials said today that Allied war planes scored their largest confirmed kill of enemy armored units so far, destroying 24 tanks, armored personnel carriers, and supply vehicles. NPR's Ann Garrels has more on the day's events.
According to Colonel Ron Richards, spokesman for the Marine 2nd Division, the Iraqis were sloppy and they were caught. A Marine reconnaissance unit saw the Iraqi tank column, called in air attacks. Richard called it the first hard kill we've gotten on a big target. It was day 13 of the war, but a senior British officer said superstition did not prevent Allied forces from getting on with the job. And by day's end at the Pentagon, Lieutenant General Kelly indicated the Iraqi Air Force, Navy, and air defense are no longer a serious threat. The focus is now on Scud missiles, command and control, and Iraq's ground forces. Iraqi planes continue to head for Iran, where 90 are now reportedly on the ground. Tehran has reassured the United States they will remain grounded for the duration of the war. General Kelly said he could not explain with any certainty why the Iraqi planes are landing in Iran, but whatever the reason, Kelly said it's a net plus for the coalition. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Israeli artillery units attacked Palestinian targets in southern Lebanon today. This attack came after several dozen Katyusha rockets were fired at Israel overnight. Linda Gradstein reports from Tel Aviv.
An Israeli army spokesman said that Israel and the Israeli-backed South Lebanon Army shelled terrorist targets north of Israel's self-declared security zone. He said there were no Israeli casualties. The Associated Press quoted security sources in South Lebanon that the Palestinian Rashidiya refugee camp had come under a fierce hour-long attack. The sources said the camp, which is home to 18,000 Palestinians, was on fire. The Israeli barrage came after the PLO fired more than 30 Katyusha rockets toward Israel, although none hit. It was the largest Katyusha attack since the Lebanon War. An Israeli army source said Israel chooses the time and place for its retaliation, whether the attack comes from Lebanon or from Iraq. But at least in this case, the Israeli response came sooner rather than later. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Tel Aviv.
According to the Reuters news service, at least two people were reportedly killed in the Palestinian refugee camp, and a half dozen people were injured. Officials in Poland say the required time for military service has been cut from 2 years to 1 year. The country's defense minister says that at present, a higher domestic crime rate is the most serious problem instead of security threats from outside the country. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 8 points to close at 2,662.62 on volume of some 156 million shares. This is NPR News. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is a clear and present danger to the world and must be stopped. Fitzwater made the comment when asked about an interview the Iraqi president gave to CNN, in which he said that his missiles could be equipped with nuclear, chemical, and biological warheads. Fitzwater said the U.S. has always assumed this is the case in terms of chemical warheads, but that it's not believed that Iraq has a nuclear weapon now. Iraq has announced that its troops have carried out what it describes as a two-pronged lightning strike across the border into Saudi Arabia. It said its forces killed a large number of enemy troops before returning safely to base. Jim Muir reports from Nicosia.
The Iraqi command's 29th war communique announced triumphantly that Iraqi ground forces had gone on the offensive. It said that yesterday evening they launched a two-pronged lightning attack on enemy positions and forward forces across the border in Saudi Arabia. It said one column of Iraqi troops had penetrated some 15 kilometers across the border into Saudi territory, while a second column penetrated 20 kilometers. The forces killed a large number of enemy soldiers and destroyed huge quantities of arms and ammunition, the statement said, before withdrawing safely to base. It's the first time the Iraqis have reported their ground forces carrying out such hit-and-run operations on the battlefront. The communique warned that the enemy would soon learn there would be further painful blows in store, and that the war would be decided by action on the field of battle and not by words. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Muir in Nicosia.
And the White House says that President Bush's main focus in his State of the Union address tonight will be the Persian Gulf War. However, Mr. Bush will also speak about new proposals for energy, banking overhaul, and other domestic ideas. The president speaks to the nation at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Many African Americans who oppose the war say that a disproportionate number of blacks may die in the Middle East. Blacks make up 12% of the nation's civilian population, but close to 25% of the armed forces. Many African Americans say that if blacks had equal opportunities in civilian life, they wouldn't have to seek education and job opportunities in the military, where they now have to risk their lives in return. We asked Ed Dorn what he thought of that perspective. He is an African American who has spent years studying race and class in the military. He's now a senior staff member at the Center for Public Policy Education at the Brookings Institution, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C.
That's true. There are costs and benefits, and that ratio changes depending on whether we're at war or not. It's important to keep in mind, however, that most of the time the U.S. military is not at war. As a matter of fact, we've had 15 relatively peaceful years. And the hope is that this current conflict will be relatively modest in duration and in intensity, for that matter. But there's always a possibility that we will experience thousands of casualties on the ground in Saudi Arabia. And if we do, it's likely that one out of every four of those U.S. casualties will be a black American. That's going to cause political problems back at home, because I'm not sure we are prepared for that type of disproportionate sacrifice. On the other hand, we also should not be surprised that this is happening. We've known for quite some time that blacks were heavily represented in the armed forces, and we've known what that meant if the nation were to get into a war.
I think that there's a lot of fear among black Americans of losing the most talented, the most motivated young people in this war, the people talented and motivated enough to join the military.
It seems the military is recruiting sort of a middle tier of people. It's not recruiting college graduates into the enlisted force, for that matter. It is not recruiting people who can afford go on to college. On the other hand, it also is not recruiting high school dropouts. It is not a haven for the desperately disadvantaged, the young man or young woman who has dropped out of school at age 16 and decided to hang out on the street cannot get in the military. Obviously, the young man or young woman who can afford to go on to college and into the professions has no interest, no economic incentive to go into the military. But there is a middle tier of high school graduates whose choice would be otherwise to take a job immediately in the civilian labor force, probably a low-paying service job with little possibility for advancement, or maybe go on to a two-year trade school. And what the data suggests is that for large numbers of blacks, the military looks like an attractive alternative to a low-wage service job in the civilian economy. And I think that's a fair calculus. I think they're weighing things precisely rightly.
Is General Colin Powell representative of how blacks can rise in the military, or is he very exceptional if you look at the larger picture?
Any four-star general is exceptional. There aren't very many of them, 30 or 40. Powell is an exceptional man, but he also, of course, stands for the kind of opportunity that the military offers. It is not at all surprising that the armed services had a black chief of staff before any Fortune 500 had a black chief executive officer. The military got a head start on equal opportunity. The military takes it seriously. And the reason the military takes it seriously is that black Americans are absolutely essential to the defense of the country. But the military has never justified its equal opportunity policies in terms of some moral commitment to social justice. The justification for opening up opportunities, not just for blacks and other minorities, but also for women, was that the military needed those young men and young women to defend the nation.
Ed Dorn of the Brookings Institution is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Ed Dorn of the Brookings Institution is my guest, and he has written extensively on race, class, and the military. Are you surprised to see how many blacks oppose the war in the Gulf?
I'm not particularly surprised. It seems to me that what we see in the polling results is that blacks are holding the administration to a much higher standard of proof than are white Americans. That's not particularly surprising. For two reasons. One is that blacks, understandably, worry a great deal about the nation's priorities, the guns versus butter trade-off, the kinds of things the nation will need to sacrifice in order to afford to spend $500 million a day pursuing conflict against the Iraqis. The fact that blacks may play a major role in that conflict also is one of those elements of sacrifice. It's part of the trade-off that blacks worry a great deal about. But blacks are also concerned, I sense, about the question of consistency in international affairs. Why are we so preoccupied with Kuwait when the nation did not seem to be particularly preoccupied with, say, South Africa's incursion into Angola? For that matter, the nation did not seem particularly concerned about previous acts of aggression by Saddam Hussein. So if you go to a community meeting in the black at a black church, what you'll hear is, how has this guy, whom we aided for the past decade, suddenly become another Hitler? Either we are wrong now, or we were wrong the past 10 years. My own personal view, if I may guarantee it, is that we are right now to try to contain and roll back Saddam's aggression. But what that means is that if we're right now, we've been wrong toward him for most of the past decade.
Can I ask what's giving you the most difficulty in thinking about the war and about where you stand?
The hardest thing for me is reconciling two legitimate but narrow views of the role of blacks in this struggle. One of those views, and you hear it articulated by a number of black leaders like Jesse Jackson and Eleanor Holmes Norton, is that blacks are essentially economic conscripts. They're in the military in large numbers because they had no other choice. Now, there's a certain element of truth in that view. The other view, expressed by Colin Powell and by George Bush, is, after all, we have an all-volunteer force. Nobody dragged these young men and women into the military. They volunteered to be there. That view also is correct. Now, the question is, how do you put those views together in a way that helps us make sense of this struggle and of the role blacks are playing in this struggle? We don't want to do anything that makes the young men and women fighting in the Persian Gulf seem like victims or feel like victims, because in fact that's not the way they feel. I've talked with a number of soldiers during the past few years. They're very proud of the role they're playing in the military. And my guess is if one goes to the Persian Gulf, one will find a great deal of pride in the ranks. But how do you reconcile that with the fact that clearly they're in the military because of a lack of opportunities in the civilian world? I think one way you do it is to commit yourself to improving opportunities in civilian society so that we don't have these glaring inequities. There's an obvious reason blacks are more inclined than whites to join the military, and it's that the military is offering them opportunities that aren't available in the civilian world. There are lots of things we can do to change that. We've got to commit ourselves as a nation to changing it. But the emphasis has to be on what goes on in the civilian world, not on the military, which has large numbers of blacks, partly because it has provided good and fair opportunities for people of all races.
Were you ever in the military yourself?
Yes, I was in the military. I was an officer stationed in Germany in the early 1970s. The war started. The war in Vietnam started winding down before I was reassigned to Southeast Asia.
So you served in Vietnam as well?
No.
Oh, before you were reassigned. I understand.
Winding down. Before
I got it.
It was time for me to be reassigned, so I never served.
Can I ask you how your personal experience affected your interest in the subject that you've been writing about, race, class, and the military?
Well, I've been interested for a very long time in the general question of equality, and particularly racial equality. I have a little background in the military, and so became interested in the fact that beginning in the late 1960s, and particularly since the all-volunteer force was begun in the early 1970s, the military became one of the few very important institutions in American society where blacks occupied prominent leadership positions. So one of the things about the military that's not as true of the civilian world is that any enlistee who spends a couple of years in the armed services will wind up having a black supervisor. That's not nearly as likely to occur in the journalistic community on the average newspaper. It's not nearly as likely to occur in the average corporation or in the average government agency. And the fact that young enlistees, black and white, see blacks in positions of authority, I think has a singular effect on racial attitudes, on the attitudes of the young blacks as well as on the attitudes of the whites. That's one of the reasons military service is important. I think there is a spillover into civilian life, that those attitudes carry over to some extent.
Do you think that the peace movement has oversimplified the politics of the war?
By definition, any movement oversimplifies the politics of the war. It's also true that the Bush administration probably has oversimplified the politics of the war by, among other things, disregarding the reason we provided Saddam Hussein so much assistance and so much encouragement throughout the 1980s. Clearly, Saddam Hussein was one of the people most surprised by the strong U.S. reaction to his incursion into Kuwait. After all, we hadn't reacted that way when he invaded Iran. As a matter of fact, we cheered him on. We hadn't reacted very strongly when he used chemical weapons against portions of his own civilian population. He must have been very surprised when we reacted so strongly to his invasion of Kuwait. So the Bush administration has simplified the issues, and the anti-war movement simplifies the issues. That's understandable. That's the nature of the political process. What I'm trying to do is occupy a position in sort of the radical middle and say, look, there are useful points on both sides to be made here. What we need is someone or some serious intellectual effort to combine the two views, the not the anti-war versus the pro-war, if I can use that term, movement, but certainly these very different perspectives with which black leaders like Jesse Jackson and leaders such as George Bush look at the question of the role blacks are playing in the military. There's an element of an economic pull there. There's an element of pure volunteerism. There certainly is a large amount of pride among those troops. How do you put those two perspectives together? I don't quite know the answer. All I know is that as long as we are sort of isolated in our own perspectives, as long as we look at this thing with blinders on, we're not going to fully appreciate the role that black Americans are playing in the military, and we are not going to come fully to grips with race relations in the larger society.
Ed Dorn of the Brookings Institution is my guest. More with Dorn in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what stories from the Gulf today?
Well, we'll have news of the combat that's been reported, but also a report from a village on the occupied West Bank where debris fell yesterday, evidently from an Iraqi scud that landed there somehow. Linda Gradstein reports on the mood of Palestinians there, which remains extremely pro-Saddam Hussein, pro-Iraqi. Also a talk with Israeli journalist Ev Hafetz about the mood among Israelis as they go to their sealed rooms during the scud attacks. And, of course, we'll be looking ahead to President Bush's State of the Union address to Congress later this evening.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Ed Dorn is my guest. He is a staff member at the Center for Public Policy Education of the Brookings Institution, a think tank located in Washington, D.C., and he's written extensively on race, class, and the military. I'm curious as to how you see your role as an African-American intellectual during this war.
I'm trying, as much as my resources will allow me, to get people to appreciate that this is not merely a one-sided question. There is, on the one hand, the benefits versus burdens matter that we've really got to weigh very carefully. But there's something else, which is that the issue that we're confronting, the problem we're confronting in the Persian Gulf, is an issue that stands on its own. We may be concerned about the role that blacks are playing in the solution, but we have to put that aside for a moment and ask ourselves a question about the essential issue, which is, did Saddam Hussein violate a fundamental principle that we need to react to? Do we have a reason for rolling back his incursion into Kuwait? And we can deal with that question in isolation. And then we can add on the other question, which is, okay, assuming in principle we object to what he's done, how much are we willing to sacrifice in blood and in national treasure to ensure that it be corrected?
And I guess that's the question you're wrestling with.
I'm wrestling with both questions. I'm trying to one audience, to black Americans in particular, to say, look, separate out the racial issue from the international issue and ask yourself for a moment, is there a problem here that the United States should help to correct? Then add on the racial stuff and ask the question about costs. But it's important to distinguish the two issues. Our reaction to the president's Gulf policy, our support for the president's Gulf policy, should not be informed first and foremost by the degree to which blacks are involved in carrying out that policy.
You said it's really important to not put racial issues ahead of the international issues. I mean, why not? Because
the instant issue is an international issue. What we're confronted with is an invasion of one country by another. And the question we have to ask is, or the questions we have to ask are, is there something wrong with that? Do we care enough about it to do something? What are we going to do? How much are we willing to pay to correct that wrong? Okay? Now, when you get to the questions about how much are we willing to pay, then you have to consider the racial matter, because it's easy to anticipate that a heavy black casualty rate is going to have political ramifications in the United States, just as heavy black casualty rates during a couple of years in Vietnam had serious political ramifications. So you got to weigh the potential political costs. You've also got to weigh other things that are being sacrificed. We are spending $500 million a day to pursue that war. That's a lot of money. And I would think that all Americans, not just black Americans, would wonder whether or not that money might not be more usefully spent. Of course, Kuwait is important. Of course, we regret that. But there are lots of things that are important happening just within blocks of the White House that also are important. And blacks don't understand. What we see in these surveys is blacks saying, look, we don't understand how the president has weighed those priorities. What a lot of the nation's mayors are saying, what they said when they came to Washington last week and engaged in some very frustrating encounters with administration officials over eight cities, what those mayors are saying is, look, we understand that weight is important. We understand that a lot of things are important. But what we don't understand is why the priorities worked out the way they did.
Ed Dorn is a senior staff member at the Center for Public Policy Education at the Brookings Institution, a think tank in Washington, D.C. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Pat Ford, with Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shirock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Since the start of the war in the Gulf, we've invited writers, intellectuals, and historians to reflect on the war. But on the next Fresh Air, we find out what Zippy the Pinhead thinks. We talk with Zippy's creator, comic strip artist Bill Griffith, who says he's obsessed with the war and is incapable of doing strips about anything else. That and more coming up on the next Fresh Air.